Welcome. Thank you for coming to this event, Engaging Hamas, Risks and Opportunities. And the event is based on a recent USIP paper by Osama Abu Arteid and Paul Sham on Hamas political thinking. My name is A. Heather Coyne. I'm with the U.S. Institute Center for Mediation and Conflict Resolution. And I'm going to turn things over in a moment to Cam Simpson, our moderator and master of ceremonies for the event, in just a moment. But at first, would like to remind everybody, please, to power down cell phones, since they do interfere with our recording devices. I'm very pleased to introduce Cam Simpson, who has been reporting on Hamas, among other things, from Jerusalem for years, and has made a career out of asking provocative questions. Huh. So he should have a field day with this expert panel on such a controversial and sensitive topic. Thank you again for coming. Cam, all yours.
Thank you, A. Heather. It's difficult to read a newspaper story, this is my own bias, any newspaper story or listen to a news story about Hamas without hearing or reading the following parenthetical clause. Hamas, comma, whose charter calls for Israel's destruction, comma, or perhaps even more directly, Hamas, comma, which is committed to Israel's destruction, comma. This is more than a parenthetical phrase that gets repeated in news stories over and over again. I think, especially since Hamas's election victory in 2006, in January 2006, which almost sent Condoleezza Rice off of her elliptical trainer during her morning workout, that this has become a frame through which much of the discussion in this country, at least the mainstream discussion, has been viewed about Hamas and about U.S. policy towards Hamas. The authors of the paper that we're here to discuss today do not deny the accuracy of that parenthetical clause. But what they do is say that two decades after that statement was written, it's been supplanted, and perhaps more significantly, that statement has little, if anything, to do with the group's everyday political conduct and discourse. I'm going to let our authors speak for themselves, obviously. And I hope everybody in the room reads the paper. It's significant and insightful. They come from very different backgrounds. They argue that we accept a new frame, one that takes into account what they portray as a long and careful evolution of Hamas's position since the charter was written more than 20 years ago. They also encourage policymakers to use Islamic jurisprudence as a window and a lever to take advantage of the openings that they believe could exist in the future. Needless to say, these are not small questions. So we have a panel of giants to discuss them today. I'm going to briefly introduce everyone. Their full biographies you should have a copy of, or they're available outside. Amjad Atallah is the co-director of the Middle East Task Force at the New America Foundation. Thanks for coming. Nathan Brown is a senior associate at the Middle East Program for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. David Makovsky of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy is also the co-author with Dennis Ross of the new book, Myths, Illusions, and Peace, Finding a New Direction for America in the Middle East. And that book has a chapter about Hamas and Hezbollah. And Wayne White, who's an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. I'm Cam Simpson of the Journal. To start things off, I'd like to ask Paul Sham and Osama Abu Arteid to give us a brief overview of their findings, and then I'm going to lead a discussion with our panel about what it all means. And hopefully in the end, we'll have time to open it up to the audience and get everybody else involved. Paul?
Thanks, and thanks to all of you for coming, and especially in the middle of the summer when conventional wisdom says that Washington is dead or somnolent. As Cam said, our goal in writing the paper is to create a better understanding of the dynamics of Hamas in mainstream American policy circles. Both of us feel the demonization of Hamas has taken over discussion to such a degree as to prevent any serious consideration of real options that do exist. If you've read the paper, you'll see it's not a policy paper in the usual sense. We're not recommending specific steps to take. Of course, The point is we both believe Hamas should and must be engaged because that's essential to progress in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which seems to be a current American administration priority. But as we all know, its ramifications are appreciably wider, and some of the arguments or insights we hope we've provided, I think, may be relevant to some other Islamist movements also. We don't believe attempting to engage Hamas is a moral question. We treat it as a political one. It is not that we approve of Hamas's tactics or strategy. Rather, we see Hamas as one player in the Israeli-Palestinian war, and it is a war, and we believe the most moral thing to do is to end the killing and create a framework that both sides can live with. It's not a matter of conferring legitimacy on Hamas. The plain fact is Hamas has become and will remain, according to all indications, an essential player. I'm going to very briefly summarize the points we're making. Obviously, all of these are worth a significant discussion. Some of them will be, I hope, brought up. The charter, we agree, is anti-Semitic. We think it is not now relevant to Hamas's political goals. Hamas has long since recognized Israel is not going to be defeated in the short or even intermediate term, and therefore it's decided, Hamas has decided, to deal with Israel's continued existence. Hamas's worldview is shaped by Sharia, and this creates a framework which has a fundamental influence on what steps it will take and will not take. From within this framework, Hamas has tried many times to signal its willingness to engage with Israel and the U.S. However, we do believe it is virtually certain Hamas will not recognize Israel in a conventional sense, since this would squarely contravene Sharia, would recognize the Zionist narrative, and thus delegitimize the Palestinian narrative. Nevertheless, Hamas is willing, even eager, to find solutions it can live with, even, of course, accepting the existence of Israel in the foreseeable future. In practice, this means pushing off the legal and religious issues to another generation and finding solutions today. The mechanisms we suggest are not in place of international law, but to be understood or taken into account by those who are dealing and applying, those diplomats who are dealing with this issue. And finally, the argument that because Hamas is a religiously based organization and therefore can't change its fundamentals betrays a fundamental lack of comprehension of Islamic law and practice, which parenthetically happens in this case to be fairly similar to Judaism's ways of changing itself. And that's the very brief rush through the paper.
Now I'm going to open it up to someone who's going to talk about some of the very specific findings in the paper.
Thank you all for coming. My presentation will be a little bit longer, more technical, and absolutely more boring. So I hope that you bear with me. I think it's rather important to start here by stipulating a significant fact that will help us understand the heart of this paper within the right context. This fact espouses the school of thought that of the Muslim Brotherhood, which Hamas subscribes to. The school of the Muslim Brotherhood is merely one school of thought among other schools in the Islamic wide atmosphere. Hamas' approach of the constant religious upon the changing political is not the only ijtihad or innovation. Therefore, its approach is vulnerable to discussion, criticism, evaluation, and amendment. And other interpretations within this same context do exist. Having said that, it's also important to note here that the Muslim Brotherhood school of thought that Hamas subscribes to is considered by large to be the mainstream ideology within the contemporary Islamic movements. And whether people will accept this assumption or not, this will not change the reality today that affirms Hamas' presence and weight in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In our report, we confirm that Hamas's comprehension and interpretation of Islamic Sharia play a major role in formulating its views and stance on the conflict. This notion is deduced from Hamas's own statements and charter, in addition to its positions and stance on relevant and related issues. In this context, Hamas, as an Islamic movement that subscribes to the Brotherhood school of thought, believes that Islam is of a comprehensive nature that regulates every aspect of life, including politics. Furthermore, it presents a solution to every problem in this life. Given this self-provided Islamic nature of the movement, Hamas believes that Palestine is a land of a unique Islamic stature, whereas Palestine is an Islamic land which is sacred for many reasons. Moreover, the land of Palestine, according to Hamas, is a land of waqf, or endowment, consecrated for future Muslim generations until Judgment Day. Based on that, it or any part of it should not be squandered, it or any part of it should not be given up. Though Hamas believes that jihad and resistance is the main way to liberate Palestine, it also understands that there is a great disparity between this ideological position and the reality as lived today. Israel does exist. Moreover, Israel is a major regional power that cannot be defeated, let alone to be eliminated under the current circumstances. Hamas does understand that. And since Hamas is an Islamic movement that believes in the comprehensivity of Islam and that it provides a solution to every problem, it set itself on an endeavor to research for solutions in Islam for the dilemma posed by the continuous presence of Israel and the absence of any prospects or alternatives to dismantle it or to replace it by Palestine. Islamic fiqh, or jurisprudence, is a wide atmosphere. It is rich in schools and solutions for different issues with different approaches. Contrary to the dominant perception in the West, it provides rational and realistic solutions rather than dogmatic ones, and it's by far more flexible than people tend to think. Hamas, as an extension of the pragmatic brotherhood, understands this and fully comprehends it. In this context, Islamic Sharia and jurisprudence provide some mechanisms to deal with such a situation when Muslims are unable to determine the outcome of a given conflict. Instead of a continuous and endless war that could deplete Muslims, Islamic fiqh introduces the concept of hudna with different variations. Hudna is a truce for a specific period which is based on the practice of the Prophet Muhammad and on subsequent events in Muslim history. A hudna provides a mechanism to wait until circumstances might change and the Muslim situation might improve, while presumably once adversaries are making a similar calculation. In this context, Hamas recognized in the early years after its inception in the late 1987 that Israel is a fact and that it cannot be eradicated at the present time. Therefore, Hamas introduced since the late 80s and early 90s the concept of Hudna, a return for a Palestinian state in the 1967 West Bank and Gaza Strip, with East Jerusalem as its capital. This mechanism, according to Hamas, to Hamas's belief, relies on past and present day edicts or fatwas, expresses the continuity of the conflict, and does not convey its end. Furthermore, it doesn't include any recognition of Israel or any historical concessions, and it's limited to a time certain. Hudna is viewed by Hamas as a ceasefire or cessation of violence for a period of time, or what we can call a phased solution or phased liberation. In contrast, the Palestinian and Israeli peace accords conceded to Israel 78% of historical Palestine, upon which the state of Israel existed today, and effectively renounced Palestinian claims to it. Of course, this is the view of Hamas. It should be emphasized here that according to the prophetic and Islamic experiences, Muslims, Hamas here, must abide by any agreement and whatever time frame that is agreed on, no matter what, unless the other party will breach it. In this context, it's only Israel or its allies that can bring this agreement to an abrupt end. This mechanism, Hudna, would evolve and develop in Hamas's thinking with time, to include the right of return of refugees without specifying to where, meaning to Israel or to the future Palestinian state. Hamas keeps this issue open. However, this mechanism, or Hudna, shows more evolution within Hamas's thinking after the Palestinian election in 2006 that gave the movement a landslide victory. Instead of plainly speaking about a Hudna, Hamas expressed its willingness to accept an agreement between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, given that it meets the Palestinian minimum basic demands in a Palestinian state in 1967 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital and the right of refugees to return. Hamas conditions such a solution to be ratified by the Palestinian states, by the Palestinian people in all of their locations in a referendum. If this criteria is met, Hamas, as illustrated in the report, signaled the willingness to accept such an agreement to help approve it from within the Palestinian legitimacy through a government coalition with Fatah. Through this mechanism, Hamas, as part of the Palestinian legitimacy after they won the elections, will recognize Israel and will respect the PLO's obligations, but as an organization. It will respect the PLO's obligations as part of the government, but as an organization, it will call this a Hudna, and it will maintain its view of the generational struggle until liberating Palestine. However, Hamas, the movement, will not violate the clauses of the agreement. This is by itself is a huge political advancement in Hamas's thought and practice. Our report emphasizes that by adopting such relatively more flexible positions, Hamas is not departing from its Islamic hue, rather it's maneuvering within it. Hamas has gone a long way in moderating its rhetoric and stances. The charter of the 1988 no longer defines the movement and its positions. In fact, Hamas rarely quoted its charter since the early 90s. Hamas makes it clear that it's not hostile towards the Jews because of their religion, and that animosity is based on aggression, not religion. Of course, if you read the charter, you'll find something different, but I'm talking about the recent positions of Hamas. Hamas reached such an understanding from within the Islamic framework, as explained in the report. Again, Hamas did not depart from the Islamic framework. However, such a relative flexibility in Hamas's stance and positions should not be by any means be interpreted as a possibility that Hamas might ever recognize Israel unequivocally or in a conventional sense. Such a recognition has Islamic ramifications. It's viewed as a denunciation of Islam and the Quran themselves, given the sacredness of Palestine Islamically and what Muslims view as an assentation to oppression. Furthermore, it's viewed by the Islamists as a dismantlement of the Palestinian and Islamic narrative. Therefore, we should not expect Hamas to do such a thing, because what it means for Hamas is the negation of its own existence. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Paul, there's an elephant in the room, obviously. It's been discussed here a little bit, but let's put it where it is, which is right in the middle of the room. Article 7 of the Charter quotes the famous hadith, and you cited in your paper, "The day of judgment will not come about until Muslims fight the Jews, killing the Jews, when the Jew will hide behind stones and trees. The stones and trees will say, 'O Muslims, O Abdullah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him.' The Charter also draws on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Article 22 of the Charter, as you guys also note in your paper, states some very anti-Semitic things about Jews controlling the world. Why on earth would anyone consider speaking with or engaging with such people until they have renounced these views? And why is that not an appropriate condition for the West to include in this dialogue?
What I'm presenting is not what I would like Hamas to do, but what I think is possible and what I think Israel and the U.S. can live with. There is no question, if the word anti-Semitism means anything, that Hamas's charter is anti-Semitic. There's no quibble about that. It repeats some of the worst anti-Semitic canards of the 20th century. That's clear. However, in my understanding, and I'm certainly not the only one, that we have shown that Hamas's actions and political statements since then show a strong desire to move beyond it. Why then doesn't it abrogate it? Because, as we point out in detail, Hamas is embedded in Sharia, in the Muslim Brotherhood understanding of Sharia. It is not going to revoke or abrogate or denounce something that is mainstream belief, even if it does not believe it anymore. Hamas is, and as long as it remains Hamas, will be part of this framework. What we're saying is their political understanding has gone way beyond the ideology. They've left the ideology behind. Now, one more sentence. Everything I'm saying is not something to be taken on faith. What I assume is that these are things to be tested in diplomatic and other practice.
I'll come back to you in just 1 minute. Now, Nathan, I want to ask you, you recognize that Hamas has built some new bridges, but you also recognize that they haven't burned some of these old bridges. Do you think that they need to burn some of these old bridges before we can seriously consider engaging and moving forward? Or do you think it's a non-issue?
Well, it's certainly not a non-issue. I mean, I guess I would say two things in response to that question. Number one, I think the question may be slightly misphrased in terms of what the contribution of the paper is, because what the contribution of the paper is, and Paul was very direct about this, it's not to advocate any specific policy position. In my mind, what this paper is doing is making serious policy discussions possible. So to go immediately to the question of should we engage Hamas, what should be the conditions, and so on, I think misses the contribution of the paper. We have to have it leaps immediately to policy instruments and makes a decision there, and then essentially writes policy back from deciding what the instruments are.
But is the evolution real without going back and changing the charter, or is it not possible? Is it still a real evolution?
Yes, certainly ideological evolutions. We've seen this in all kinds of ideological movements, that formal revocation of previous ideology is usually the last step in an evolution rather than the first step. We see that with communists. We see that with socialists. Certainly in this case, they certainly have not burned their bridges. And I think that they are unlikely to do so anytime soon, specifically on the charter. Partly it's because of the nature of Hamas as an organization being a little bit of a disparate movement, and therefore trying, sometimes definitive actions are a little bit difficult. There are some people who would want to move one way, some people who want to move another way, and it's sometimes difficult for the movement to come to a decision. And the other thing is that right now, what the movement I see itself as priding itself as being is the Unfatah. Okay, and what did Fatah do in the eyes, at least, of Palestinians? I'm not talking about in the eyes of their interlocutors, but in the eyes of Palestinians. What Fatah did was try and jump through every single international hoop held up for it, and did so sometimes convincingly, sometimes unconvincingly, and ultimately is now on the point of petering out as an organization. And Hamas is not going to do that. They're going to say, we're going to stick to our principles, whatever those are. And the more that you talk about the charter, the more we're sure we're not going to change it.
Excellent. David, what do you think about that?
Look, I don't know where to begin. I have personal high regard for Paul Sham. I just met Osama. So when I voice disagreement, I hope it is not seen as personal in any way. If I was in the USIP audience listening to this, it would sound, well, there's this dry legalism of a charter of 20 years ago, but what's important is political flexibility, and that's what counts. I would say here, I'd like to make three broad points, if I may. On each one of them, I could go on for about 3 hours, but I will try to be within a couple minutes if I can. One is, I think this very provocative essay, I think, is misleading because it creates the sense that there's this charter that's anti-Semitic, but come on, let's get real, and it's reality that counts. The reality that counts is what they're doing now in this decade. Hamas's whole approach is only violence can be used to solve this conflict, and their idea of solving the conflict is that Israel should not be the size of a telephone booth on a Tel Aviv beach. It has nothing to do with the 67 borders that they say is a way station for them. Their use of violence is the real elephant in the room, in my view, not the charter. It's that the glorification of suicide bombers that I think we see, this goes way beyond the kamikazes and the Japanese in the 1940s. This is something unique we've had in the Intifada, and I want to be clear that people suffered on both sides, and no one has a monopoly on suffering, but their approach to deliberately target people in pizzerias, discos, buses, over 100 suicide bombs that killed 1,000 Israelis, that's real. That's not a charter of the 1980s, and people have to be motivated to do that, and there's a whole Hamas doctrine that motivates them. Now, not in a piece of paper. And that also involves, as soon as Israel gets out of Gaza, not just what happened in 2008 with Tadia firing rockets on Israel immediately. Actually, no one has done more for the Likud than Hamas, because they prove what the Israeli right wing has been saying, which is you get out of land, you're more vulnerable, you're not more secure. And there's been about 4,000 rockets since Israel got out. I know that people say, but the way they got out was unilateral in the siege, and we could all talk about that. But this happened the day after. It didn't happen 3 years later. And this use of violence is not limited to Israel. It's throwing Fatah people out of windows, summary executions, 2007, not the 1980s. So I think there's a misplaced focus here, that the whole focus here is like, oh, there's only this whole legal issue, when the issue is 1,000 times deeper than the legal issue. The second thing is, if I was listening in this audience and I wasn't familiar with all the nuances of this conflict, it would sound very reasonable to read this paper and say, well, you know, Hamas was really willing to deputize Abbas, Abu Mazen, to solve this conflict, and then they would have a referendum. If I was listening to this audience, I'd say, that's reasonable. What could be bad with that? What I would argue is, if you don't know the fine print of this conflict, that this is really a massive act of deception, not by the authors, which I'm not accusing of at all of bad faith, but of Hamas itself. Specifically, their whole approach is to have what they call a referendum, is every Palestinian in the universe should vote, and it's clear, even the authors say this in the paper, that there's no way that Israel is going to agree to a right of return, which Mashal just repeated, not just as an abstraction, which he said no leader can waive. And he said that they have to go back to their homes where they were in 48. It wasn't an abstraction. And so it's likely that not all the Palestinians in the world are going to approve of this referendum, maybe not even by majority vote. But by putting these killer amendments in there, and it was, right after Jimmy Carter left, Mashal was interviewed on Al Jazeera the same day when when Carter said, I got this referendum, and if you read the fine print of the referendum, it's not that the people in the West Bank and Gaza vote, it's that everybody votes. And clearly the terms is not something that everyone is going to approve of. So I find if you don't follow the fine print of this conflict, what you're going to read in this paper sounds very reasonable, but the more you know about the nuances, the more you realize the devil's in the details. It might sound boring, but I think that's an important point.
Let me just move on from there. I want to get to Amjad. We'll be back. Amjad, is this paper an exercise not by the authors, but is it reading an exercise of deception by Hamas? Or do you think that this should at least be a window through which policymakers start new discussions moving forward?
Well, I think that the authors, I think what you guys have done is very clearly brought out that Hamas is two organizations. And in a sense, there are two different questions. When we talk about engaging with Hamas Islamically, engaging with Hamas along the terms of Islamist jurisprudence and Islamist theology, that's actually a debate that takes place with Muslims. That's a debate among Muslims with Muslim organizations. It's not a debate that the United States or Israel, as combatants in this conflict who support the occupation, are going to be able to have with Hamas. So that's, I think it's important to recognize that to the extent that I would agree that debate needs to happen, that debate needs to happen among Muslims, and it needs to happen among Palestinians, regardless of whether they're Muslims or not. Then there's the question about how should the United States, as Israel's ally, deal with Hamas, which is a political question. And that question, I think, we've already answered in Afghanistan, we've already answered in Iraq, we've already answered elsewhere, which is if we have combatants who are engaged in conflict with us or with our allies, we need to find a way of dealing with them. We either need to defeat them militarily, and if we don't defeat them militarily, we need to find out what their legitimate aspirations might be within the constellation of demands that they've set out, and we need to see how we can potentially accommodate those concerns, those legitimate concerns, while continuing to be opposed to the negative ones. And so, for example, if we were dealing with if we didn't have the unique internal American discourse about Israel that sort of skews the conversation, if we didn't have that conversation, then the way we'd be talking about Hamas today is the same way we'd be talking probably about the Sunni insurgency or about the Taliban or about another group, which is, you know, this group has things that we just can't stand. I mean, they support things and they call for things that we find abhorrent, but they're a real problem. We've got to find a way of dealing with them. Let's talk to them all and see which ones of them we can break away from the fold. Let's find out which ones might buy into our minimum demands. Let's see which ones, let's see if the organization as a whole can be flipped. Let's see if the organization as a whole can be changed. And I think we've got to have that conversation on two different levels. There's got to be the conversation of how the West handles and deals with Hamas, and there's the conversation of how the Muslim world and the Palestinian community interact with them.
And so what does this paper tell you about the possibility of reaching into the organization and flipping part of the organization, or having at least openings with part or some or all of the organization? Does it inform that question for you?
I don't know if this is true of all derivative movements of the Islamic Brotherhood, but the Muslim Brotherhood, but they've all they tend to be constituency based. They tend to only go as far as they think their constituents are going to buy into. So, for example, why aren't any of them calling for a caliphate? Why aren't any of them calling for the unification of the Ummah, of the Muslim community? I mean, Islamic jurisprudence doesn't recognize the nation-state system except as a reaction to the reality of it. It doesn't affirmatively promote it. So why is it that they are willing to be so pragmatic? And because they're constituency-based. They look at what their constituents will buy into, and that's how far they think they can go. Sometimes they'll try to lead it, sometimes they'll try to push it, but Hamas isn't attempting to implement Sharia law, for example, even today. Why is it not attempting to, like, legislate Sharia law?
There's not a little of that happening in Gaza? We haven't seen of that since June of 2007?
We have seen it in Gaza. But even there, it's because they believe that the constituency will buy what they're pushing. they're not pushing beyond what they think the constituency will buy. And so the fact that Hamas is a constituency-based organization means that there's, in fact, a lot that could potentially be done with them.
Great. Wayne White, is this paper reciting and buying into a campaign of deception by Hamas over the last 20 years?
No. I actually found the paper quite interesting and in its length, more digestible than some of the longer treatises, and a lot more interesting in its depth than some of the things that try to do this in two or three pages, just to be very practical about, you know, getting through it. No, I found it very, very interesting. Just a point of information on this, the bit about the charter. You know, I'm glad the paper pointed out that quote by Mashal, you know, which said that we'll grab any charter of revolutionary charter and you're going to find, you know, absolutely objectionable language. In some cases, charters have been left behind. And let's face it, Israel agreed to engage with the PLO for years with the PLO charter still containing extremely objectionable phraseology, which was still in play toward the end of the process. And so if charters are going to define us out of existence as far as engagement, we're in real trouble, you know, on this front. I found that the two challenges of assumptions were very useful. The first, a challenge related to the fact that Hamas cannot evolve. Clearly, it has evolved. Whether the evolution has become of significance with regard to closure remains unknown, and I don't think that they pushed that any further than they should have. And whether the current isolation, you know, and strong pressure against Hamas is the only way to go as a second assumption, it absolutely, desperately needs to be challenged, because we've gone through three bankrupt years, a savage, you know, exchange between Israel and Hamas, and we've gotten absolutely nowhere with this policy, and so that's a non-starter. I have to look at this very, very practically, and that's all I'm trying to do here. Are there drawbacks? Of course. They've been pointed out by some people, but any meaningful Israeli-Palestinian peace process must include Hamas if the process is going to have any realistic chance of generating a useful end product that gets us to closure. Critics can contest this, but look at the record. Anything that comes out of a process that excludes Hamas is going to be without a Palestinian mandate, probably due to be stillborn. I don't think that success, if we proceed with Hamas, is all that possible. But I know that without Hamas, a meaningful result is impossible. So, I mean, literally, I'm just getting to the point where you're sacking up maybe a 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 chance of success against a 1 in 50. If not worse. And so I'm trying to be just brutally practical in what I'm saying. I think President Obama is well placed to depart from this past policy, which has been stillborn for several years.
Let me get back to that in 1 minute real quick. I want to bring Osama in because I want to ask you, before we leave the charter, which I have a feeling might not happen anytime soon. We're going to, not just the charter, but Hamas's actions in furtherance of the charter, in furtherance of the statements of the charter, as David pointed out, is the real issue on the elephant in the room. Osama, why can't, first off, Hamas burn these bridges of the charter? Is there something inherent in Sharia, in the organization, in the Brotherhood, that makes that impossible? And why is it not an issue in your eyes?
No, I think we have to understand that the charter of Hamas wasn't thought of, wasn't adopted by the movement when it was released. It was forced on Hamas. When Hamas started in late 1987, they needed a political program. And this political program was set forth by the Gazan branch of Hamas. Hamas didn't accept the charter, but it was forced on it. And they couldn't abandon the charter because it will be seen as a surrender to the pressure. And the give in. So Hamas never.
As Nathan said, the more people push to step away from the charter, the more Hamas will.
Actually, I will give you another piece of information.
But is that a political?
No, it is a political.
Or a religious?
No, it is a political reality because, up to my knowledge, that Hamas came up with a new charter in 2006 before the elections. But Hamas had to delay the release of this charter, the new charter, because they won the elections. Now, after they won the elections, if they will abandon the previous charter or the current charter now, they will be viewed as caving in to the pressure. They will be viewed as being now integrated into the political process that they have long opposed. Now, what we have to understand that the charter itself is confused. Even when it tackles the issue of Judaism and the Jews, the same charter that speaks about an eternal,
the things that I read about,
yeah,
Judaism,
eternal struggle with Judaism and the Jews, it is the same charter that speaks about the Jews living in peace, Jews and
people
Christians living
book.
In peace, people yes, people of the book under the Islamic rule. So the issue for Hamas is that the Jews controls Palestine, occupied Palestine, quote unquote, and that's the problem. It's not that their own the mere question of their existence. Now I want to go back for quickly to the hadith that you mentioned.
Yeah.
One of the points that we made in our report, that Hamas did not depart, did not abandon its Islamic framework or its Islamic background. What Hamas did, it's that it moved from one position to more flexible position with by espousing the Islamic umbrella and by espousing the Islamic jurisprudence. According to the books that reported the hadiths, this hadith was reported in different narrations. One of the narrations says that the Jews will fight you, that it's not you, the Muslims, who will initiate this fight. And based on this narration, Hamas said that we base our animosity now towards the Jews and towards the Israelis who occupy Palestine, the Jewish, the Israeli Jews who occupy Palestine, because of their occupation and oppression as they view it, not because of their religion. So this is an issue that we have also to understand. I don't think.
And there have been a lot of statements over the years.
Yes, Khalid Mish'al, the chief bureau of Hamas, just recently, about a year ago, made a very important statement when he spoke about the Jews and the people of the book as citizens of the Muslim world, not as dhimmis or quote unquote second class citizens.
Let me go back to David. David, I want to ask you, and I hope you don't feel like we're ganging up on you here.
Why should I think that?
Obviously, Hamas sees itself at war with Israel. It has had hoodlums in the past. But does see itself at war with Israel. And the violence that you mentioned, there's a long, long, horrible record of violence. But as Amjad pointed out, we now have a president, President Obama, who has, well, let's start with the Bush administration. We had a president, President Bush, who allowed the U.S. government to make deals with some of the worst Sunni insurgents in Iraq to literally, I believe, buy them off. I think that's probably not an unfair characterization of the Sons of Iraq program, which is still effective today. President Obama has said he believes in that program, and he believes it could be adopted in Afghanistan with the Taliban, who I think probably everyone would agree are certainly more extreme in their rhetoric and probably in some of their actions, especially when it comes to things like Sharia and the application of Sharia, than Hamas has ever been. What's wrong if we can, in those contexts, speak to those organizations? What's wrong with considering an opening to speak with Hamas? Why is it a taboo subject in this context and not in the other context?
Well, I'm not an expert on Afghanistan, and I don't want to speak to that. I think one of the objections that I think also was missing in the paper was not looking at the wider context on the ground, which is even when it came to the PLO, which, by the way, the PLO met clear criteria to win U.S. Recognition after the 1988 international recognition, what Arafat said in Sweden about renouncing terrorism and the like. By the way, this idea of criteria was also when people always invoke the IRA and the Sinn Féin, and I refer you to page 249 and 250 of George Mitchell's biography about being a negotiator in Northern Ireland. And I could read you the six principles of Mitchell that Sinn Féin had to accept as their entry ticket to getting in the Northern Ireland talks. So this idea of set criteria is not just about here, in the case of Hamas. It was there in the case of the PLO. It was there in the case of the IRA. In the wider context here, I would argue, is the fact that there is such a thing as the Palestinian Authority and Fatah, And to me, that's not a footnote. That is a big piece of this. And
you were just in Ramallah.
Came back from Ramallah on Sunday night. I spoke to, I think, dozens of Palestinians. And frankly, when I was weighing whether to participate in this, what kind of tipped me over was this irony of people in Washington saying, well, you know, talk to Hamas. And all these people in the government, in Ramallah, and outside the government thinking it was ridiculous and it would be the death warrant of them. Because for them in the authority, it's clear. That is, they stuck their necks out for a two-state solution. And now it's they're going to look like Quislings if you could be a killer and be kosher. That's how they see it. They might didn't use the word kosher, I should add. frankly, Hamas just said it this week. You know, if we would join a uni government, this would mean the end of Israeli-Palestinian security cooperation, which has helped quiet the West Bank in the last few years and is making giving Obama any chance to succeed. And I give the president a lot of credit for making an effort here. So we can't just look at the Hamas issue in isolation. We have to look at what does this mean for the people. Are we trying to basically help the people that maybe we should be hurting and hurting the people that we should be helping? So I feel that that is one dimension. I would also add in a more regional context, if it's enough to have a Hudna, a ceasefire, a long-term ceasefire, what does that mean for Egypt and Jordan that have peace treaties with Israel? Won't their Muslim Brotherhood chapters, which they have too, say, forget all these peace treaties, let's throw them down the drain, let's do a Hudna? This is the first Muslim Brotherhood chapter to govern anywhere. And if we want to all of a sudden change all these rules, we can't look about that in isolation. We have to see what is it. What are the implications of this for the West Bank? What are the implications in terms of relations with Egypt and Jordan as well?
Amjad, I want to ask you first. We're going to go back to this quickly, but I do want to ask you first. Why can we have a conversation like the one I outlined about Iraq and Afghanistan and not about Israel and Palestine with Hamas?
My own personal opinion, I could be wrong and I'm open to better arguments, is that in the United States, obviously, there is a very strong political constituency against Hamas and against anything that would be perceived to weaken Israel's negotiating or bargaining position.
There are also leaders in Iraq and Afghanistan who have very different views about engaging Islamists, right?
And that's the second part that I wanted to comment on David's piece. Now, I was also in Palestine about a month ago, and I probably talked to some of the same people, and I talked to other people as well. And I think David's right that Fatah's argument and the leaders of the PLO argument, it's more, but there's a nuance there. It breaks down, I think, into two different camps. There's one camp that effectively says, you know, we can't really compete with Hamas's charity and its efficiency in running ministries and its ability to provide social services and its
lack of corruption
mechanism. The lack of corruption, I think a lot of people still think that Hamas may be secretly corrupt. But we can't compete with that. And so don't bring them into any political process with us because they'll defeat us. I mean, we can't win on a level playing field. So don't give us a level playing field. Make sure that we stay on top. Okay, so that's one argument. But then there's the other argument of people who recognize that that position is unsustainable. And that includes the so-called young guard of Fatah, but I would say it includes the majority of Sanam Fayyad's cabinet right now, which says, well, this is unsustainable. I mean, we can't ask the United States and Israel to defeat the political party that is stronger than the one that's in power. So that's not the way that we're going to win this. We can only win this politically. And the only way to win it politically is to strengthen the hand of those that are secularists and moderates, etc., by Western lexicon, and let us play on a level playing field with Hamas where we can win.
I want to ask Nathan real quick. We're beyond the four corners of the paper at this point, obviously. We might go a little bit further. Is it a bad idea to force Hamas to deal with the PA, to force Hamas? If we get down that road, as you know, as the Palestinians themselves got in 2007, is it a bad idea to leave a structure in place that would force Hamas to deal through the PA?
Well, first, the premise of your question is wrong.
Okay.
Hamas is the Palestinian Authority in Gaza, period. Okay? Not just legally, although it is, it has a very strong legal claim.
Yeah.
In reality. So we've got two Palestinian authorities. And the talk of a Palestinian authority being only the government in Ramallah is factually and legally misleading. I do have problems with discussions that go immediately to policy prescription and then try to work back from there. So should we engage Hamas? How should we do it? And this sort of thing without stepping back and thinking, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? I think I would go to a comment that Wayne White said earlier. It is impossible to have any settlement or any diplomatic process that ignores Hamas. It is just stillborn. It's also true, and I'd probably be even more pessimistic than him, that trying to integrate them into a process immediately that would result in a diplomatic agreement immediately is probably, he says, 1 in 5. I think you're optimistic. Therefore, I think we have to take a longer-term perspective. In any kind of sort of short-term or interim arrangements, you have to have some kind of calm on the ground. And if you're ever going to get to a point much later on, and not probably in this administration, even if it lasts for 8 years, where you have a meaningful diplomacy leading to any kind of resolution. I'm not sure that when that would be possible, but when it is possible, it will not be possible without dealing with some kind of reunified Palestinian leadership. For those reasons, yes, you have to knit the Palestinian political system back together, or you have to encourage that process.
There was a chance to do that, and it started to happen in 2007. Why did it go off the rails?
Essentially, under Saudi,
went off the rails is an understatement, given what happened in June 2007 in Gaza.
It didn't fall; it was pushed. There were lots of people doing the pushing. The United States government was one of those parties, but it was certainly not alone. And I'm not American-centric enough to believe that the United States called all the shots there. There were certainly people in Hamas who were very nervous about that experiment. Mahmoud Zahar, who had been foreign minister in the previous cabinet, stood up on the Legislative Council and explained that this was a mistake, that it was dragging Hamas into a process that might, lead it to accepting things that it said it could not accept. He still voted for it as a matter of party discipline. So there were problems, and it was based in an agreement that I described at the time as much more loophole than text. So it fell apart essentially, I think, because there were people on various sides within Fatah, within Hamas, within the international community, chiefly the United States, that wanted it to fail, that wanted to make sure that it didn't work. That doesn't mean that it couldn't work. I think if we went back to a policy, or if we adopted a policy that was based on knitting the Palestinian Authority back together, it would be on much less favorable terms than we could have had in 2007. But I think it probably is still possible.
And a necessary first step before we even think about a policy involving engagement with Hamas, I suspect.
I think engagement with American engagement, with the real engagement that has to take place is intra-Palestinian. It's between Hamas and its Arab and other states in the Arab world. It's between Hamas and their constituency. I think as Amjad was saying earlier, if direct American Hamas diplomatic contact somehow feeds into those processes, by all means we should do it. But this is not a theological issue for me. Maybe for Hamas, maybe we have to understand it in religious terms from there. But for me, it's not, and I don't think for the U.S. government it should be.
Amjad, I'm going to take David's side for a minute, and I'm going to gang up on you quickly. You said that Hamas is pushed by its constituency, and I believe probably pushed by its constituency more than you think it's pushed by its religion. So what was wrong with the policy of the Bush administration and of the world to try and push the constituency into accepting a Palestinian Authority led by Fatah and into rejecting Hamas in the long run? If Hamas can be driven by its constituency, what was wrong with the policy of reaching over Hamas's head and trying to push the constituency?
Well, first of all, the United States fundamentally undermined its democracy agenda by insisting that Hamas be a participant in democratic elections and then immediately working for the overthrow of the democratically elected government.
The election was a small bump in the march of freedom at that time.
Well, yeah, that was then later followed by the birth pangs of freedom, and then there were a number of things that the United States did that effectively were the equivalent of suicide. It was we killed our own policy. And the policy. Oh, you're right.
Yeah, that's much better. Apologies to everybody in the back of the room.
The policy on you missed everything I said. No, the policy on Hamas fundamentally undermined U.S. credibility everywhere in the Muslim world and in the Middle East. So we can't now go back to. If the United States wants to influence the constituencies of Palestine, you don't do it by overthrowing a democratically elected government. And so I do agree the United States should work on the constituencies, but not in the way that it did. President Obama has actually been quite clever in reaching out over the heads of leaders, political leaders in Europe, in the United States even, and in the Middle East, trying to go directly to the people and create a new narrative where the United States isn't the bad guy and it's not us versus them. That's really, really very important. It shouldn't be a one-off. It should be the beginning of a process in which we can do this. And I want to agree with David on his emphasis on the violence issue, because I think where Hamas is weakest, where they're most vulnerable, is in their use of violence against civilian targets.
And their failure to renunciate violence as well, I believe. I mean, I don't
well,
think
not
even
to renounce violence. Not to renounce violence. I don't really believe there are Palestinians who honestly think that they don't have a right to use violence against Israeli soldiers who are in the occupied territory. That's they may say we're not going to do it, but whether they think they have no right to do it is a different issue altogether. But Hamas's use of violence against civilians, that you can get a lot of Palestinians. You can walk them through it. You can talk them through it, and you can get them to the point where they say, right, we can't. Okay, yes, Israel uses violence against our civilians. Does that allow us to use violence against their civilians? And that's where Sharia actually could be quite helpful, because Islamic jurisprudence has a rich history of discussion about the inviolability of civilian deaths and about how you can't attack civilians. And it puts Hamas on the defensive. When President Obama tried to say in Cairo that Hamas and the Palestinians effectively had a right to resistance, but nonviolent resistance, he used all the wrong examples to prove it to them. He talked about South Africa, he talked about the civil rights movement. Both were for one-state movements. Both were for democratic, egalitarian, mm-hmm. secular states and not two ethnic states, not national liberation. And it's hard to find too many examples where you could say nonviolence can be used. But you can at least lower the bar and make civilians out of the picture. You can make civilians holy again. You can make civilians sacred again. And that's a discussion, I think, that the United States has under Obama, the moral resonance to actually be able, couldn't under Bush, but it has under Obama the ability to at least begin this conversation. And if Fatah wanted to take advice and not commit suicide itself and not continue to slash at its own wrists, that's where Fatah could have a debate with Hamas that would improve its stature mm-hmm. among its own public.
Wayne, I want to ask you, you were, I think, still in the intelligence community when the policy of the Bush administration, as you see it, was, I think, as you told me, going off the rails. In the region at large, and also, you think, specifically with Hamas, David talked about regional implications of involving Hamas at any level. What do you think about that prospect? What do you think about potential regional implications of a policy that even quietly starts to let Hamas under the tent?
Well, you can go with the interpretation that David, the warnings that David laid out, which aren't completely without substance. But Hamas is in power, and the other Muslim Brotherhood organizations are not in power. And, you know, they may be able to work this a little bit, but I really don't see those dangers as quite as significant. again, taking a rather practical approach. I would like to point out as a historical footnote here that when we're talking about the awakening, there's an interesting thing there about charters, and maybe it's not a charter or whatever, but the United States did a separate deal with the elements, tribal, former insurgents, and what have you, that made up the awakening, with the awakening still rejecting the Maliki government as essentially a stalking horse of Iran, an illegitimate government of occupation, and that government bitterly objected to the awakening. It was only after about 18 months that elements of the awakening started getting sort of fat and happy with how things were working out and actually wanted engagement with the government and wanted to take salaries and et cetera, et cetera. But initially, it was a bold move that the United States did in defiance of Baghdad. And so that wasn't an easy one either. And so people often point out the Taliban as being particularly, you know, distasteful, but that wasn't exactly wonderful either. As far as the region, the democratization thing is extremely interesting because I think the initiative that was launched for democratization was not especially aimed at Hamas, it was one of the things that I was alarmed over, not because I don't support democratization in the region, but because there was an element of exaggeration, almost delusion, in this press for democratization, implying that, and this was the thesis, one of the things that got us into Iraq, which is much neglected, which is the assumption that we could move into Iraq, turn it into a model democracy, and that way create a beacon of democracy that would cause the collapse of autocratic, you know, regimes, particularly the two next door in Damascus and Tehran. And I just said this was bankrupt. You weren't going to create a perfect state in Iraq and what have you. And I warned specifically in a memorandum of the entire community in Iraq and INR assessment that not only was this a very tough sell, not only were elections being emphasized a little, far too much into the neglect of the rest, despite the rhetoric, you know, that shouldn't be done, but since, you know, and this is still true despite the Obama bounce, practically all publics in the Arab world are far more anti-American, anti-Israeli, and militantly Islamic than their governments. And so if you hold an election, what do you think you're going to get? And Hamas was the first glaring example of what I was trying to warn about in February of 2003. It's fine to push democracy, but you better be ready to deal with the results and deal with them on a level playing field.
I don't think allowing Hamas to participate in the elections was a very well, I mean, factually speaking, I don't think they spent a lot of time thinking about it before they acted.
I would also like to say something about, you know, the Palestinians and how we've been able to work with, you know, the Abbas duplicate government or whatever you want to really call it. And that is, it's fine to the extent that if you want to patch together a temporary modus vivendi, you go in that sort that direction, but I really think that dealing only with them is a wasting asset, and that what I thought Paul and Osama were talking about is trying to take a crack at a final settlement. And frankly, concerning even Hamas, I don't think, despite all the analysis that can be done, investigative analysis and what have you, and what Osama did so well, you're never going to really find out what the bottom line of Hamas is until you actually engage them in the pressure of negotiations, unless they really know this is it. Now, again, the thing about 1 in 5, maybe it's worse. Yeah, maybe I'd put it even worse than that. I tend to be pessimistic and make it 1 in 20 or so. But it hasn't been tried. They've never really been put on a level playing field with the Palestinian Authority, even temporarily. And we're not talking about, you know, in other words, when I'm talking about something practical in terms of policy, I am not talking about according recognition to Hamas.
Right.
I'm essentially talking about treating Hamas like Hamas wants to treat Israel. In fact, not even as well. a tahadiyya or perhaps a shortened hudna merely for the purpose of negotiations and for the duration thereof, as long as they remain meaningful. Lifting of the blockade, except of course for arms and other, you know, oversight, and making it quite clear that this conveys no legitimacy whatsoever, and that with the failed conclusion of negotiations, we go back to the other policy.
David, that sounds a lot like armistice that Israel reached with its neighbors after 48. What's wrong with an idea like that? I've heard Ephraim Haleve say very similar things to what Wayne is saying, and Israel itself did negotiate a hudna.
Right. Look, I think you have to, on the issue of truce, either short-term, meaning tahdiyya, or long-term hudna, which is probably the centerpiece of this paper that as I understood it, I think, look, of course that both sides have their own tactical interests in truces, but I think we shouldn't pretend that self-interest for a truce, by the way, of both sides, is flexibility. Let me just tell you what Mashal said last year. Again, I don't like to talk about charters and 25 years ago. I like to talk about here and now. This is what he said last year. Hamas and the other resistance factions will use the tahdiyya to grow stronger, both in terms of weapons and training, and that the people will recover and prepare for the next round of resistance, because we're talking about a tactical tahdiyya. And tahdiyya is short-term, long-term. By the way, people think it's an evolution. Hamas has evolved. Sheikh Yassin said this 10 years ago. You know, they haven't evolved, I think, the way it's been portrayed. The point is not that these things are not useful. They could be useful to all sides, but let's be clear that doesn't mean anything to do with flexibility. It means, like Mashal says, it means rearmament. And even in the paper itself, when it says, I thought it was extremely, you know, caveated and iffy, saying, let's say the most you can hope for is a 10-year tahdiyya, a 10-year truce. It says, these seemingly arcane formulations are meant to provide a basis under which Hamas may be able to coexist with Israel for a period of time. Now, their idea of a 10-year truce is that Israel, you make all the political concessions, give us everything, and including that every Palestinian can go to his home and that there'll be a referendum by every Palestinian in the world, and we don't do anything, and for that, we'll give you a 10-year breather so we can rearm. Again, I can understand from their position why they would want that, but to dress that up as flexibility, to me, is a farce. And their views have not changed, I don't see, very little. I mean, I would say like this. I like sports, and I'm going to use a sports analogy. As some people know, I like sports. So if this was a football field, and we were at the one-yard line near our end zone, and we want to go a touchdown, and we might say, look, Hamas cannot run 99 yards on a field because theologically, given Islamic law, they view every inch of historic Palestine, meaning inside Israel, as waqf, as Muslim holy place, and they can't agree to it. So don't ask them for something they can't agree to. And I would say, if Hamas moved 99 yards down, you know what, 80 yards, 70 yards, 50 yards, but certainly 99 yards, but even less than that, if they moved down the field and really evolved and saying, look, we don't deliberately target civilians. We want to work this out with you and have permanent coexistence, but, you know, theologically, there's something we just can't do. But everything up to that point we can do, we'd be having a very different discussion, in my view. Maybe that's what Nathan Brown meant by a sense of a debate. But I feel that we're nowhere near that. We're about 99 yards away from that. And that, to me, is the issue. Not that they can't score the touchdown, but they're not close to scoring the touchdown. If they were close, we could think very creatively. And by the way, there's no shortage of Jimmy Carters and all sorts of people who run back and forth with messages. The issue is not a communications problem, and they don't have to be faced with certain things. There's enough retired British MI6 ambassadors, ex-CIA, 47,000 different intelligence people that are willing to, I'm not saying names, that are willing to convey messages if the messages were there. But let's be honest, folks, we're nowhere close. And the means exist in this modern world to convey messages if they have to be conveyed.
I want to ask Paul. Paul, the paper puts forth that we are not on the one-yard line, and we don't have 99 yards to go on these questions. How far do we have to go, in your view?
I don't think it's useful to use an American game as an analogy, because I think
count off your prayer beads
and tell me how many are left.
What I think David misconstrues in the paper, and David is an old friend and we have great regard for each other, but I think he is seeing this as a fundamental break and acceptance of Hamas as the interlocutor. And there is nothing, I think, or I certainly hope, in the paper that indicates that at all. What we're talking about is changing the dynamics of the discussion and understanding things that I think David is ignoring. Hamas's record in what it is saying politically is mixed. And at the best, Hamas has to be tested. Most Palestinians that I've spoken to over the years, I haven't been in Ramallah in the last month or two, but most agree that eventually Hamas and Fatah have to work together. What I have yet to hear from David or from most Palestinians I speak to is any mechanism other than let's keep attacking Hamas and helping the PA. I don't think anyone can say that Hamas is on its way to disappearance. If Hamas were not a major factor, I wouldn't be advocating dealing with it. But I see liberation struggles in general, such as the British, to take a weird example, bringing it back to the U.S., the British dealing with the Continental Army. Totally illegitimate, except after 7 years, they showed the British that they couldn't hold on to the state. And so it, in a sense, legitimized itself as a player. What we are saying is that partly because of mistakes that have been mentioned, not only, that Hamas has achieved the power of a player, and whether it can make peace has yet to be determined. The conditions of certainly the violence against civilians is something that has to be part of that. But what Hamas's essence is as was said, I think Nathan said, and I think this is one of the most important ways of understanding, it is the anti-Fatah. Mm-hmm. Its means is resistance. It feels, and I think one can make an argument for this, that the approach the Palestinians have taken to Israel has not been successful. I would so what it is trying to do in this is show its right wing that it is not giving up. We need to stop the veto, the effective veto that we have on Palestinian unity, and allow processes to go forward, still supporting Fatah.
Nathan, I want to ask you a question. Paul repeated something that Wayne also talked about, and I know that you've talked about, and that is the idea of these ideas needing to be tested with Hamas. How can that happen? Do you agree that this... we need an environment where these things can actually be tested and we can find out what the limits are, what the realities are, and how might that happen?
Absolutely. It may sound a little bit strange, but what I would do is I would go back to what something that David McCoskey said at the beginning of his remarks. He says, not so concerned with the charter, with the language. Again, I mean, I don't think you look to sort of foundation ideological text for all kinds of reasons. He said, I care about what they're doing now, and I care what they've been doing recently. And that's probably what to focus on. And there we actually have a little bit of a record to go on. We've seen sometimes when Hamas has laid down conditions for a unilateral ceasefire, okay, for when they've laid down negotiations for what they want in terms of a negotiated ceasefire, what they want in terms of a hudna. Certainly the hudna that David described is a non-starter for Israel. It's essentially saying, give us everything you wouldn't give Fatah and get less for it. So that's a non-starter.
But it's an opening position maybe as well, or...
Yes, well, that's what would have to be tested. I wouldn't necessarily rush immediately into a Geneva peace conference with Hamas at the table trying to figure out exactly what do you mean by this. My hunch is they themselves don't know exactly what their bottom line is, or right. Different individuals within the organization have different bottom lines, and they would have to argue this out vociferously for some time. So I think what you have to do is to get them in a process where they are somehow invested in some cessation of violence, where they're invested in a process where they actually do have something to lose by a return. You know, it's not so much do they renounce violence, but are they practicing it, and put them in a position where they have something to lose by practicing it, and only later at that point, and we're probably talking about a period of some time, do you then worry about testing what the bottom line about a final settlement?
Well, what does the process you're describing look like? What do you think it would look like? Would it look like what we saw in 2008?
It could look like what we saw in 2007 in Mecca. It could look like what we saw in 2008 in terms of
Egypt brokering.
Yes, and what seemed to be happening in a sense in January 2009. I think those agreements were very badly flawed. And they were very badly flawed because they were two unilateral agreements. They were unwritten. Each side had different understandings of what it was that it had agreed to, a different set of conditions. Each side essentially made no commitment to the other, nor to any kind of monitoring or anything like that. That's a kind of process I think that would be healthy at this stage, but it has to be an awful lot better done.
Baby process, well executed, if you will, much better executed than the processes that we had in the past.
Absolutely, yes. And that probably demands an American blessing, and it demands probably an Egyptian role as well, and perhaps some other parties as well, yes.
Okay, great. Amjad, please.
One thing I think we need to consider, because I think we're talking about this as if Hamas's goal is to be in the negotiations with Israel.
Does Hamas want to be even sit at the table with the U.S.
With
anyone?
Well, I think with the U.S., yes. I think with Israel, no. I think that we have to at least consider the possibility that Hamas's goal is in fact what it's actually said it to be recently, which is they want to be in Ariel Sharon or Bibi Netanyahu's position. They want to vote against peace and then be able to benefit from the fruits of peace. They would like Abu Mazen to be the one to fall on the sword. They would like the PLO or Fatah leadership to negotiate a deal, and they'll sit in the back and they'll say, oh my God, you gave up refugees. You are such horrible people. But the Palestinian people support it. We pledge that we would endorse that. We will now be able to run on a platform where we'll say, you know, you guys were lousy negotiators. You gave up the farm. People should vote for us. We're going to be better at running the Palestinian state. But, of course, because we promised that we will implement the existing agreement, we'll implement the existing agreement. And so that way they win both ways. They keep their ideological purity.
They've been winning both ways for a while, haven't they?
Well, I mean, I'm as much as the fact that Fatah is losing more doesn't necessarily mean that Hamas is winning more. I think Hamas has is not content with the way the circumstances are today, because they do have Palestinian national interests in their calculation. And so, I mean, they can't possibly be happy with the way the situation is among Palestinians right now. But if, in fact, that's what they want to be, if they want to be Ariel Sharon or Bibi Netanyahu, that may not be the worst thing.
Excellent. Wayne, I'm sorry, you wanted to say something earlier and I missed you. Is the moment gone?
No. I think that one of the things that we've, a couple of people have devalued seemingly, is the notion of peaceful coexistence. In other words, in the absence of an absolute and final and definitive agreement, there is no value in peaceful coexistence, which, if that had been the position of the United States and the Soviet Union during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, this might have been a much more frightful world. When we engaged in peaceful coexistence and then detente with the Soviet Union, we didn't require the Soviet Union to abandon its determination and its ideology to eventually defeat the West, et cetera. It was just recognized that the two sides were so dangerous to each other, you know, that it was better at least to tolerate something, some interim arrangement. And, you know, in that instance, somebody might say, well, that was in the face of mutual, you know, and total destruction, a nuclear war, and that trumps everything. But on the other hand, Israel and Hamas are in a very, very destructive, you know, relationship, which exploded, you know, within the past year terribly. And it would seem that just even putting an end to that should not be devalued as something that is of no consequence, you know, in this process. But, you know, even speaking about Jimmy Carter and envoys and everything, the reason why I really think it is necessary to have Hamas pressed and forced to
test it, as
do
said.
This, to carry out this internal debate, is that I don't think personally that Hamas values Jimmy Carter and many of those envoys any more than some of us do.
Mm, yeah.
And therefore, they do extract this, they do extract that, because of course Hamas wants a friendly ear, but on the other hand, they're not going to find the bottom line either.
Osama, you was something you wanted to respond
to. Yeah,
so.
I just have a few points actually to make, but I will start from a point that Amjad just made when he spoke about Hamas's intention to vote against a peace agreement and allow Fatah to negotiate while Hamas oppose and enjoy the fruits of it. We have to remember that Hamas is a movement on constant changes now. Hamas is a dynamic movement. The recent speech by Khaled Mish'al from Damascus, Khaled Mish'al made a very explicit statement when he said that Hamas's intention now is to be part of any efforts to ensure a lasting peace and a lasting settlement. That was the statement by Khaled Mish'al. Yes, that doesn't mean that they will abandon their own ideological convictions. They will maintain their ideological convictions, but on the political level, they are willing to be integrated into the political process. I'm not sure if they will accept to negotiate with Israel or not, but as Zahar made the statement a few years ago when he said there is nothing in Islam that forbids Hamas or any Muslim to negotiate with his enemy. So I think there are differences, different views within Hamas itself. And the problem that the U.S. and Israel are not giving Hamas anything substantial to give Hamas the justification to or a reason to justify any move forward. Hamas views the conditions that are set forth by the Quartet as more of an attempt to humiliate the movement. That's why you see Hamas is more adamant in its positions. Also, I want to bring into mind two premises of our paper. I think that they're absent from this discussion. One, we didn't try to, in our paper, at least according to my understanding, and of course Paul has the right to correct me, we didn't try to convince the United States and Israel to deal with Hamas or to accept Hamas claims.
Yeah.
What we said that Hamas is sending signals now, and either you accept these signals or not. And the second point that we try to make here, that any dealing with Hamas should be out of necessity, not out of conviction, because this is Hamas's position itself. Hamas doesn't deal with the U.S. and Israel when it comes in relation to the peace process out of conviction. It's out of necessity. But again, there is a bottom line for Hamas, a bottom line that makes it clear, even though if it's going to be a hefty price for it, that we would never recognize as an organization. We would recognize from within the legitimacy, from within the government. We are the PA. That's Hamas's view, that Hamas is the PA. Abu Mazen is without mandate. His term expired early this year. So for Hamas, it represents the legitimacy within the Palestinian society. Yet it's willing to accept a negotiated deal by Fatah. Also, I want to go back to something that David said. Look, yes, the PLO did amend its charter, but what we have to understand, what we have to know, that Fatah never amended its charter until now. Now there is a civil war within Fatah because of the upcoming sixth general conference, if it will ever take place in Beit Lahem. Yes, if it will ever take place. There is a civil war within Fatah among the, not the, the old guards and the new guards, actually among the old guards themselves. Like Al-Qaddoumi, who's one of the founders of Fatah, and Abu Mazen is another founder of Fatah. Al-Qaddoumi just came and accused Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the president. He just accused him that he wants to change the nature of Fatah as a resistant movement. The charter of Fatah until today, 16 years after Oslo, still speaks about historical Palestine and about resisting Israel by means of arms. So we accepted to deal with Fatah, but we are hesitant when it comes to Hamas. I think that we should re-examine our approaches. One final note, if you don't mind.
Please.
Amjad said something interesting, that the Brotherhood and Hamas are motivated more by their constituencies, okay, their supporters, their bases, more than their ideology. I don't really believe this. The Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas still believe in a caliphate system. They still believe in the unity of the Muslim Ummah. But this again shows you that this organization, this school of thought, the Muslim Brotherhood, and which Hamas subscribes to, are far more flexible than what you think. They are maintaining their convictions, but they're willing to deal with the reality. Mm-hmm. I think that's where our chance is. And one final note, I'm sorry.
Please.
One final note. I participated in a conference in a European country, and there were some Israelis there. And I remember a statement made by an Israeli who's a minister now in the government, who said, and he was addressing me, that you don't understand the might of Israel. My response to him was, yes, Israel is a very powerful country. We understand this. It's maybe it's the most powerful country in the region, at least. But you're not here because you suddenly had a conscious awakeness that you came to sit with Palestinians. Israel has its own dilemmas. Israel has its own risks. Israel feels the dangers that threaten its own existence. If not today, maybe tomorrow or after tomorrow. That's why I think we have to be realistic when it comes to this point. It's not only that Hamas needs the West and Hamas needs Israel. Israel and the West needs Hamas, because Hamas doesn't speak for itself. Hamas is far more popular in the Arab and Muslim world than maybe it's in Palestine. So we have to understand there's a huge base for Hamas, a huge base within the Muslim quote-unquote ummah or nation who believes in what Hamas believes in. So if you want to go and deal with Abu Mazen and deal with Fatah by itself, I think you are dealing with the wrong side, because they cannot court in the overwhelming majority maybe within the nation, if you want to believe that it's an issue. So I think it's out of necessity for both sides, and that's what we're trying to say in our report, not to sell Hamas, not to make Hamas look as a Jeffersonian democracy, as Paul put it. But you know what? We have also one final note. I've been deprived for a while now.
No, please, it's fine.
One final note. You know, as when David mentioned that he sat with the PA officials in Ramallah, and you know, they complained about engaging Hamas and that will undermine their position. What do you expect from them? Do you think that it's because they have ideological differences with Hamas, because they are for peace and Hamas against peace? No. They are against Hamas to be integrated because they are threatened by Hamas. One person, one vote for one time for the Islamists. It's one person, one vote, one time for the entire Middle East. That's how these regimes, who are secular, are ruling. They're not Jeffersonians as well. So we have to understand this.
David, first, I want to ask you a question that Osama raised, and then I want to let you. You have a lot of notes. And I know you're anxious to speak. You've been deprived. Everyone has been deprived. I am the depriver.
I didn't accuse you.
No. George Bush was the decider. I'm the depriver. I'll take that role.
George Bush, you mean?
Yeah.
Not George Mitchell.
Yeah, yeah. He says that Hamas needs Israel, and Israel needs Hamas. I accept the first premise. Hamas does need Israel. because Israel, as everyone knows, is far, far, far more powerful than Hamas. Does Israel need Hamas for anything? Or can, in the eyes of Israel, can the current state of affairs continue to exist until it's necessary, again, in Israel's eyes, to go in again, as we saw at the end of last year and the beginning of this year?
Look, you know, because your question actually relates to something that Paul said, and anyone who reads what I write knows that that is certainly not my view, which is is that there's only a military solution for Hamas.
Right.
I mean, that is totally antithetical to my own thinking, and you know, I think it's a very legitimate discussion for another debate about what should the right policy towards reconstruction of Gaza and things like that be. And there was one point I did come close to agreeing with in this paper, which was that, you know, it was true that Israel, and to your question, that in this Gaza conflict, Israel, I think, was about 150 meters from the Shifa hospital, where the Hamas leadership was in the basement. And Israel knew that the Hamas leadership was in the basement. And now you could take that and to say, that proves that if Israel didn't go into the basement of the Shifa hospital, apart from the humanitarian concerns, it shows that Israel needs Hamas, because else why didn't Israel finish off Hamas? And, you know, you could look at that half both ways. You could look at it to say they didn't finish off Hamas because at a time that there was no PA that was functioning in Gaza, the alternative of nascent small little jihadi groupings, you know, would scare Israel more. You know, but I think you could also look at it to say, yes, that's in terms of an initial vacuum, but if there was a PA that was functioning from the West Bank, there would be someone to take over. I'm really worried that with this whole session, that this audience, I think, is getting a very wrong impression that Hamas is somehow 10 feet tall, it's the wave of the future, Fatah is the past, and therefore, we just got to go with the wave of the future, it doesn't matter. And therefore, I mean, I brought these statistics of two leading polling agencies, one of a fellow named Khalil Shikaki, who's done work for the U.S. Institute of Peace, called PSR, Palestine Survey Research in Ramallah, another called JMCC, Jerusalem Media Communication Center. And this poll was taken in June 2009. Again, my whole focus is look here and now and not about charters 25 years ago, and I don't think that's the way to focus on any of these issues. By the way, it was Arafat saying mutual recognition that was significant, not what was in the charter. You don't have Hania saying anything comparable. But on the polling data of last month, both the figures, the JMCC poll said that when asked Gazans, let's focus on Gaza because that's where the bulk of support for Hamas is. Who would you trust between Fatah over Hamas? The number is 34.6 to 26.9, Fatah over Hamas. And the same question is asked at PSR. Who do you support more? It's not the same as who do you trust. And the number is 40.6 to 24.9, Fatah over Hamas. Hamas is eroding everywhere we see it because they haven't delivered. They're not the 2005 Hamas of Washington think tanks that they do social services. That's the future. They're contracting. They haven't been able to give social services to anybody except their own members. They've taken flour and all sorts of stuff that's been brought in by the international community and giving it for guns for their own people. This isn't the social service Hamas that some may think. This is a Hamas that keeps on contracting. And somehow I fear the perception of this session is that Hamas is the future and Fatah is the past. And if you listen to Gazans, by the way, the same Gazans who said that Hamas lost the war, no matter what was on Al Jazeera, and I agree with what Osama said, maybe they have more support outside the Palestinian areas than inside the Palestinian areas. I think that's well said.
Well, that's not what I meant by that.
Okay, but that's what I heard. The two last points I would just make are, well, very short ones. You know, I wish Amjad was right. I would love Amjad to be right. That
about
their,
what?
Their opposition is tactical. That they would love that basically for there to be peace and they could say we opposed it. But I tend to think they have a coherent worldview. And when they put forward these ideas on referendums, I think they're going to say whatever Abu Mazen has done is illegitimate. And therefore, people worry, are they going to be spoilers from the outside? But everything I see is that spoilers from the inside, they talk about these things called prisoners' documents, which I could go through with you, and was mentioned, alluded to in the paper, where they said this we can support, but others we can't. So I tend to think that they have a much darker view of peace, and it's not just playing a tactical game. And the final 2 points was just we say the U.S. stops processes. As far as I know, the ongoing talks in Cairo being sponsored by Egyptian head of military intelligence, Omar Suleiman, no one is stopping those people from meeting. But I asked the people in Ramallah, and they said there's been zero progress. Hamas's views do not change. So I don't think it's the United States. These talks are going on. If they wanted to come together, they could, but they don't. It's interesting, the Egyptians, who some for tactical reasons might say they want a unity government because they're afraid that Israel is about to dump Gaza on their lap, the same Egypt under Mubarak during the Gaza conflict was willing to have all sorts of protests against Egypt and open up a crossing point in Rafah to Hamas. That's not something Egypt wants. And the final point about U.S.-Soviet relations, you know, let's be clear that in the Cold War, there was some very high baselines that exist in the Cold War that don't exist here. The United States and the Soviet Union, for the most part, there was diplomatic relations with everyone. Since the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was even hotlines, red phones and things like that. We're nowhere near that standard that there was during the Cold War. So I could go on about that point, but I don't want to do it. But I think the analogy is not correct.
I don't think you should have used it. I don't think we should have gone there at all.
No,
David talked about the past and the future. The future is now with you. So I want to open it up for questions here at the end. Please introduce yourself, and I reserve the right to cut you off. Sir, here in the corner. Take the there's a microphone right here. If people could come up on their side.
In the article, it was talked about the language of Hamas with nuance and subtlety, and I guess I see more contradiction and ambiguity, and so I wondered if you to hear
contradiction in what specifically? Where do you see contradiction?
Is it small d Democrat? Is it authoritarian in its rule? Is it accepting, as they say, the fact of Israel's existence, or is it like Haniyeh said in a speech last year, Haifa is ours, Jaffa is ours?
Okay, I'm going to leave it at. Can you introduce yourself real quick? I'm sorry.
Michael Vame, Rethink the Middle East.
Great, thank you, Michael. Gentlemen, Osama and Paul.
No, I mean, look, we didn't try to defend Hamas. Yes, it was ambiguous there because Hamas is ambiguous about this issue. We didn't try to invent something for Hamas to sell Hamas to the West. Hamas is ambiguous about this, and we said it clearly. Don't expect Hamas to recognize Israel in a conventional sense. Now, what is the other alternative? I think our assumption is from within the Palestinian legitimacy. Hamas tried to enter the PLO in 2005, in the March 2005 dialogue between the Palestinian factions in Cairo. They wanted to be part integrated into the Palestinian institutions, and they will accept any obligations of these institutions as part of the legitimacy again, not as a movement. So Hamas is ambiguous about this. It's very clear, and we try to make this clear in the paper. We're not trying to invent something and to convince you of something that doesn't exist. Hamas says it clearly. Don't ever expect us to recognize the right of Israel to exist, because this is the negation of our own narrative, the negation of our religious beliefs, and the negation of the very reason of our existence.
Okay, thanks. Osama. Yes, sir, on this side of the room. Introduce yourself, please.
Yap from Israel with the Jerusalem Report.
Okay.
What I've missed in this discussion is the Arab Peace Plan. When I listen to promoters of the Arab Peace Plan and you ask questions about Hamas, then the answer is if there is a perspective of peace between Israel and Palestine, that will take away the oxygen of organizations like Hamas. And then the question is Hamas in the future, if there is an Arab Peace Plan, and if on that basis Israel and the Arabs can do business, is there a future for Hamas, or will it be weakened to the extent and popular appeal will be weakened that it may be not so relevant as the premises here?
I'm going to throw that to Nathan and Amjad. I'd like you guys to talk about whether or not the role of the Arab Peace Initiative in the process and how it affects Hamas, how it might affect Hamas, and how Hamas might view it.
I was hoping you'd throw it to the other end of the table. I'm not sure it's all that relevant de facto for them. I don't think it's necessarily good news for them. I mean, because it sort of spells out a vision that fits in a little bit more easily with the formula. The closest that they were able to come was in the
formula of the quartet?
The formula that Hamas was able to come to regarding the Arab Peace Initiative was in the form of the prisoners' document and the Mecca agreement, you know, talking about respecting past agreements, but it was absolutely explicit that
persons recognizing
did not mean being bound by them.
Right.
And beyond that, I think my hunch is that their attitude is they will cross that bridge when they have to come to it, and there's no sign of much vitality to this initiative right now.
Amjad.
I mean, just remember that Hamas's initial response to the Arab Peace Initiative was the Passover bombing, suicide bombing, which gave Sharon the pretext to begin dismantling Arafat's Palestinian Authority. So the... I think that it goes to the Arab Peace Initiative goes to the question of this internal debate among Muslims and among how they're going to deal with Israel. I mean, so far Fatah and the Arab state governments have taken the position Israel's too powerful, we can't defeat them, the best way to do this is through the United States, and through them we'll be able to get this. That's not a message of reconciliation and peace, it's a message of acknowledged weakness. So it doesn't have as much emotional resonance for Arabs or Palestinians as a message that appeals to a more robust sense of responding to your rights and defending your rights. But the two, both narratives, the one presented by the resistance groups, whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah, for example, or those presented by the let's rely on the United States crowd, both of those lack an actual game plan so far, because the United States hasn't been willing to actually deliver a peace deal. If the United States was willing to deliver a peace deal, it might justify the path that Arab autocratic regimes and Fatah have taken. But Hamas hasn't also presented a programmatic way of saying, well, through resistance, this is how we get back our rights. And okay. So there's something really desperately missing from both of them, and a narrative that ultimately leads to true reconciliation.
David, anything on the... Okay. Ma'am, can you introduce yourself?
Andrea Barron, the Washington Center for Internships. I'd like to first thank Paul and Osama for a fascinating paper and for the U.S. Institute for Peace for convening this panel. And I actually have a question for Osama. Amjad said about how not attacking civilians is an integral part of Islamic jurisprudence. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, has there been any discussion within Hamas, theological, not political reasons, for adopting the stance of opposing all attacks against civilians? And if not, why has that discussion not taken place?
Okay. Now, let me tell you how they comprehend this issue. Hamas sees or thinks that its attacks on the Israeli civilians is out of retaliation. This is not a position that Hamas adopted before 1994, before the massacre in Hebron. They issued a communique at that time, and they made it clear that if you stop attacking our civilians, we will stop attacking your civilians. So Hamas's rationale here is that we're trying to inflict the same pain on the Israeli society in order for the Israeli government to understand or to cease any attacks on the Palestinian civilians. So it's out of retaliation, and they thought that this is the only way to convince the Israeli government or to compel the Israeli government of its stopping its attacks. I'm not aware of any theological discussion or any ideological discussion within Hamas. Maybe there are political discussion. Is this beneficial to us or not? But I don't think they're questioning, because they can find many justifications within the Islamic Sharia that if people oppress you, you have the right to oppress them in the same way with the same magnitude.
Right.
The Quran is very clear here. Now, I'm not trying to justify Hamas's position, okay. But I'm trying to tell you how Hamas see things, how Hamas present its argument. Now, unless we understand this, I don't think there's a way to deal with it.
Let me take it a step further and on the religious question and suicide bombing specifically, because this is a different area. And I think until Afula in 1994, actually it was Palestinians of all Sunnis involved in the first suicide bombings of Sunnis.
Where?
In Afula in 94, I believe, was the first Sunni.
Yeah, after the
Sunni,
Hebron massacre, yes.
The first.
Yeah.
Now, religious prescriptions against killing civilians and justifications for that are one thing. Mm-hmm. But there is different jurisprudence when it comes to suicide.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So explain that.
Okay.
And is there a discussion within Hamas about suicide bombing?
I'm not aware of any discussion. But again, what happened in 1994, I think it was the first bombing happened in Afula in April 6, 1994.
Yeah.
It happened about 40 days after the massacre in Hebron. What Hamas thought of, the way Hamas justified it, that we cannot stop the killing of our civilian but by inflicting the same pain on the Israeli civilian to stop their own government. That's how they justified it. Now, the only way for Hamas to inflict the same pain on the Israeli society is to resort to these kind of attacks, because they don't have missiles, they don't have tanks.
But again,
so
isn't that a political question?
Now, to be clear about something, suicide is prohibited in Islam if it's out of desperation. Now, if there is a justification for this, such as what's happening in Palestine from their own view now, that this is the only way to resist, this is the only way to stop the killing of our people, then there is a discussion within Islamic jurisprudence. I'm not saying that there is a consensus that this is acceptable or permitted, but there is no consensus among the scholars to oppose it. So there is a ground there is a frame for disagreements within this issue, but Hamas, I think, they adopted the point of view that it's permissible under Islam to protect your own civilian and to do to inflict the same harm on others. But that's how they view it.
Thank you. I want to move to the side of the room, sir. Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Rafi Danziger from Feedback, and I would like to make a couple of quick comments on two things you said, and then as well as the question. Very quick comments.
Speak up. Can you speak up and into the microphone?
Can you hear me now?
Sort of.
Okay, I'll speak louder.
Okay, thank you. I don't think it's working.
It's not working?
Yeah, no, there you go.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, please.
All right, to Amjad, with regard to the Hamas election, I think there's no question that the United States made mistake in the way it handled it, and I think that Bush officials also admitted that. But I think the mistake was not accepting the results of the democratic election that were democratic. The mistake was to allow and to actually force Israel to accept an organization that is not just a political party but has a militia that, as you yourself said, kills civilians to participate in the elections without giving up that militia.
Although I want to interrupt you quickly. I mean, there was a precedent already for that in Iraq, allowing people in Iraq to participate in elections that had militias and were actively fighting. So I think the Bush administration had crossed that line, and it was very difficult at that point for them to go back. Just please, but go ahead.
But I think that Bush officials have admitted that was a mistake here that really caused a lot of problems later, because they did not insist, as Israel wanted, to first for them to give up the arms to stop killing civilians. And with regard to Osama, I think that with regard to the Fatah, you made a comparison between the Fatah charter and the Hamas charter. Indeed, the Fatah charter is just as obnoxious as the Hamas charter, but I think there's a fundamental difference, which is the Fatah is part of the PLO. The PLO has accepted Israel. Arafat, who was the head of both Fatah and the PLO, accepted Israel, recognized Israel officially, and Fatah is on the program. And therefore, as Arafat himself said in a different context, it's caduc, the issue of this Fatah charter really is obsolete, and it's no longer an issue, whereas Hamas is never undertaking that kind of commitment that Fatah has. But I think the bigger issue is with regard to, there was a reference to elephants in a room. I think those were just baby elephants. I think the really big elephant in the room is the biggest struggle in the region, between those forces that want to maintain more or less a status quo, that is those governments, the Arab governments, if you said correctly, are not to facilitate democracies by any stretch of the imagination, but they want to maintain a status quo, they're willing to work with the West, free for the flow of oil, all of that, and those forces that want to topple the existing order, and that's Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, and others. And I think Hamas needs to be viewed as part of that context, because Iran supplies arms to Hamas, Iran trains Hamas, and I think the discussion can only be complete if you don't include that part of the issue in the conversation.
Wayne, you're shaking your head. I want to know what you think about this big picture view of Iran driving the train here.
Well, I think that we can go, a lot of people go too far with that. Iran is not driving the train, and in fact, as with so many trains, like Hezbollah, militias in Iraq, often Iran wishes it was driving the train and is often flattered to hear people saying that it is, because Iran is often frustrated by the same lack of influence over so-called proxies that we are over some of the parties we influence. You know, the Iranian relationship with Hamas was shaky from the very beginning. We knew from the inside that, ironically, Iran was absolutely disinterested in Hamas when it was established in 1988. Regarded Hamas as something backed more by Saudi Arabia, an enemy, even partially by Israel, and it was just thought to be a minor faction on the. It was similar. Parallel was its early attitude toward Muqtada al-Sadr in Iraq, not wanting to be affiliated with a violent, unguided missile, potentially, in Iraq. And only after Hamas had proven its spurs in the first intifada did the Iranians come knocking on its door almost a year after its establishment and say, do you want the aid now?
And it had given aid to
asked for earlier. And actually Hamas, in its anger, refused the aid for another 6 months. A little known, footnote to this. And so it's been a very shaky relationship. And I don't think provision of arms here and there is really what we're talking about. Hamas is running its own operation. I really think it's ideologically self-contained in the main. And to are there connections with? Is it part of a regional issue? Of anti-establishment movements that are often Islamist, in bent? Yes. Is Iran driving the train in Hamas, regarding Hamas because of those connections? No.
One last question we have time for, and then I'm going to invite people to come up and feel free to talk with anybody who is still remaining on the panel. Sir?
Yes.
Can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, my name is Frank Fouladi. I'm Muslim, Persian native, proud Marylandian American patriot. I think for it's nice to see so many people from Hamas here, and Mr. David also, you're welcome to see you. The Hamas people in Maryland, they recommend a piece of land in the border of Rafah in Egypt and Palestine. This area can be a very nice free trade zone with homes and hospitals and colleges.
Do you have a question?
Yes. The question is, in order for me to develop this land, who do I have to get approval? From Hamas or from Israel? And by the way, I went to Israeli embassy and I told them that, you guys that arrived to the...
I think we need to send your question to the United Nations and we'll let them try and sort it out.
Such a nice panel. I was wondering, maybe you can give me some ideas.
One more question. Go ahead, sir, right here. Please introduce yourself.
My name's Lee Diamond. I'm a Jewish peace advocate. I'm frustrated by what I see as a sort of a circular logic among some people with regard to the Palestinians. I hear, we talk about Hamas and Fatah. Amjad and I were at a PLO, an academic conference that was sponsored by Georgetown University in April, and it was from the perspective of the Palestinians, you know, Fatah is almost universally rejected. Now, that may be because they keep the Young Turks out of the picture, and maybe if the Young Turks can come into the picture, that'll change. But I wonder if Amjad in particular or anybody else would, you know, address the notion that we're, are we trapping the Palestinians in a sort of stagnancy in a Neverland where they, you know, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't, and shouldn't we be interested in breaking out of the through conventional wisdom?
Through what process do you mean? Through our continuing support only for the PA and
well,
Fatah?
Part of it is intellectual discussion, to be honest. I mean, I certainly think that David's written many great things, but I think on this panel today, I mean, we sort of heard him endorsing a sort of circular logic and not wanting to get beyond that because that gets uncomfortable.
Okay, Amjad, the question's to you.
Well, I don't know if the question was for me or for David, but I appreciate your comment, Lee. I think the first, I have to agree with David on something he said. I mean, there are a lot of people who are disgusted with what the Fatah leadership, the old guard, may be doing, but at the same time, those people are Fatah. So, I mean, you know, they may be vehemently opposed to the kinds of inaction and passivity of the Palestinian leadership that exists in Ramallah at the moment, but at the same time will vote for Fatah because they're Fatah. They've been Fatah since they were born. They fought with Fatah in the early days. They fought in the First Intifada with Fatah. So we have to understand it's a more nuanced situation. It's not Hamas good, Fatah bad, Fatah good, Hamas bad. For Palestinians, it's a very complex, analysis that they do when they have to figure out who they're supporting. There are a lot of people who wish Fatah, who want Fatah to succeed, but are disgusted with the way the Fatah leadership has gone about it. I think that ultimately the question really is for the United States: how do we get to a comprehensive peace agreement? And is engagement with Hamas at some level necessary in order to further that aim, or is military confinement, the current policy, military confinement and military defeat, an available option? And is it, you know, does it fit within the ethos of what the United States is proposing around the world? Does it fit within the morality that we've proposed? And will it accomplish our objectives? That's the question that they have to grapple with. But I want to say one last thing about President Carter and other people who have actually gone out and at great personal risk to their reputations and talked to Hamas. Hamas right now is under tremendous pressure. Fatah, is engaged in, you know, cracking down on them in the West Bank. They're arresting them. They're some are being assassinated. In Gaza, Hamas is reciprocating towards Fatah. The siege on Gaza is horrific. I mean, it is really, really making Palestinians pay a huge price. And so, obviously, Hamas at some point will have to respond. At some point, it will have to try to break out of the corner that we've put them in. Now, what President Carter, what European states that are talking to them, what individuals who are trying to talk to them are doing is, in fact, giving them an incentive to stay on the pragmatic approach. What they're doing is giving them an incentive to believe that there's a benefit to becoming more moderate. There's a benefit to being more pragmatic. If President Carter wasn't going and talking to them, for example, they would have no reason to suspect. I think they're wrong in believing that President Carter came as an envoy of President Obama, but at the same time, it's good that they believe that because it gives them more incentive to at least consider where they might need to go. And if anything, we should be encouraging a little bit more of that and not disabusing or calling them naive. I mean, I think President Carter, in that sense, is doing a tremendous service for Israel and for the country in helping to keep Hamas engaged as opposed to thinking that when are we going to have to start firing rockets into Israel again.
Excellent. Thank you very much. We could continue this discussion for another 60 years and beyond, probably.
And we may.
But I want to thank Paul and Osama especially for a wonderful, thoughtful discussion and for bringing us to the table. And I want to thank everybody for coming today. And I want to thank Amjad and Nathan and Wayne and David also. And thank you. And some of us will stick around. Thank you.